Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Austin Peterson, and welcome back to the Freedom Report. I'm here with a very special guest, Kathy Reisenwitz. Kathy, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Kathy is an associate at Young Voices and an editor-in-chief of sexinthestate.com. Kathy, what is Sex in the State all about?
Sex in the State is kind of the intersection of social justice and small government.
Mm-hmm. So what are you trying to accomplish with this website? Like, what are some of the big issues that you try to call attention to?
Absolutely. So I started out trying to figure out how can we appeal to kind of demographics that have traditionally either ignored libertarians and our ideas or been kind of hostile to us. And so I began to see ways in which the state was particularly oppressing ethnic minorities, gays, and single women. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, found no shortage of those kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. But then as I got into, intersectionality and social justice, like I said, and kind of structural racism and things like that, I began to realize that while the state is the vehicle that has been traditionally used most often used to oppress people, mm-hmm. The oppression comes from kind of a deeper cultural place. And so that kind of needs to be part of the conversation as well.
I think you're probably right about that. I mean, I consider myself very socially liberal, even though I don't think that people who are necessarily social conservatives are not libertarian. I mean, like Ron Paul, for example, like I would call him libertarian, even though he lives his life as a social conservative. I mean, do you see that like that there's sort of a distinction there, that not all social conservatives necessarily, you know, even if they don't live a social liberal lifestyle like yourself and myself, for example, they can still be libertarians?
No, I would definitely say, of course, they can be libertarians. The question is, what do we want libertarianism to be and to offer?
Mm-hmm. Okay, could you expand on that?
Sure. I think that one of the issues with kind of where social conservatives come from is that they have not been traditionally super aware of or concerned with things like cultural oppression, slut shaming, structural racism, things like that. And mm-hmm. so I think that people looking from the outside at libertarianism see that. Mm-hmm. They see either a denial of those problems mm-hmm. or an apathy toward them. Mm-hmm. And I think if libertarianism is going to offer anything to those populations and just millennials in general, who I think are more concerned with those issues than generations past, mm-hmm. We're going to have to get concerned with and aware of these issues.
Okay, let's talk about slut shaming, because this will segue into the next discussion about the debate that you had with Julie Borowski, because feminism really never came up on my radar until Julie did a video about how do we get more libertarians in the movement, and she was like, you know, butts, orgasms, and she did this hilarious thing, and then you did a response to it, talking about, hey, these are some of my favorite things, you know, let's not dog this, you know, slut shaming is wrong, blah, blah, blah. Now, here's my thing. You know, I don't like slut-shaming. I think it's probably effective, even though I don't agree with it. And the reason why I think that is because one time somebody fat-shamed me because I had gained a lot of weight, and it was a beautiful woman who was a model that I really respected, and I kind of wanted to date her. And I actually went out and, like, lost a lot of weight and improved myself. I mean, maybe the ends don't justify the means, but I mean, you wrote an article talking about how slut-shaming is sort of unjustifiable coercion.
Right.
But I mean, coercion, when I think of coercion, I think of like force. You know, how can we possibly influence each other's behavior in positive ways without these sort of non-coercive mechanisms?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like,
absolutely.
You know, sticks and carrots, but it's not really like force. It's more like, you know, how can we justify sort of like improving society without these kinds of like what I think are non-coercive means?
Sure. And I want to make something very clear that I feel like I didn't in the article. Mm-hmm. I thought I did, but apparently I didn't. When I say slut shame or shaming is unjustifiable coercion, what I'm not calling for is any kind of coercion to combat the coercion. So I would never advocate for the law coming in and right. saying you can't shame others. I would never put any kind of limits on speech, but especially that kind of limit on that kind of speech. That's mm-hmm. not what I'm saying. When I say it's unjustifiable, I mean it much more from a cost to benefit and moral perspective,
okay,
not a legal perspective.
So do you think that that slut shaming doesn't work? I mean,
there's good evidence that it doesn't. There's good evidence that, for example, there was just a study that came out that showed that women exposed to fat-shaming media consumed more calories mm-hmm. as a result. So, you know, there's that aspect to it. I think generally the way people's psychology works is that they respond much better to positive reinforcement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you find it problematic for women to be promiscuous, I think it's much better to sell them on abstinence. Mm-hmm. It's much better to educate them mm-hmm. on some of the downfalls. And yes, of course, it's, you know, it's tricky to say, well, if I point out that eating a, you know, bag of chips makes you fat, is that shaming or is it education? Well,
exactly, yeah.
It kind of comes from, what kind of person do you want to be? Are you doing it to shame them? Are you doing that to make their lives more difficult, needlessly? Or are you doing it to say, hey, I'm your buddy and I want what's best for you?
Okay, so one of the things that I think that confuses people, and there's no monolithic, this is what feminism believes, you know what I mean? And so a lot of feminists, they tend to be from the left, and when I say the left, I mean people who want more government control. And they do these things they call slut walks, and they
right.
go out and they sort of like proud slut, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they kind of adopt it as like a positive label. So how do we sort of, you know, deal with like discussing these cultural issues when there's just so many definitions and nobody can really say, how can we pin this down? I mean, what do you think about slut walks, for example?
Slut walks are really interesting. I think a lot of people don't know the history of slut walks.
Mm-hmm.
It started when, I'm sorry, I'm not as well versed on this as I should be, but I believe a police officer basically blamed the victim of a rape on what she was wearing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of something that happens where police officers will often take a victim and discredit her.
Mm-hmm.
They'll bring up their sexual history, what they were wearing, where they were,
mm-hmm.
whether they were drinking, because they don't want to be bothered with doing their jobs because their deference is to the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
And so the slut walks are about saying, you know, it doesn't matter what I'm wearing, I still deserve to not be a victim of assault.
Yeah. One of the big issues that's coming out right now is related to Title X. You know, President Obama is pushing hard on college campuses from the Department of Education to sort of basically put pressure on these schools in order to deny mostly young men the rights to due process if they're accused of sexual assault on campus. What do you think about this?
I mean, I think that's a terrible idea. I think what we've seen over and over again is that schools are terrible, terrible arbiters of what goes on their campuses. I think, you know, trying to keep it in the school and not get law enforcement involved. Law enforcement has done a terrible job, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't trust the school to do any better. And so I think this is a move in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you know, the president, we reported on this yesterday, the president inflated these numbers of women who are raped on college campuses. And it's just like, it seems to me like we're sort of, not only do we demonize women's sexuality, but with this idea of, you know, sexual assault on campus, we're also demonizing young men in a way. So it feels like when we talk about issues from a feminist perspective, you know, it always comes in terms of the patriarchy. But it almost, in reality, when we look at like biological gender roles, it feels like that it's nature that's really put us into these roles because we've adapted to these roles as a means of survival. There's this great documentary, it's called Why Sex, PBS documentary, and they took a look at species and their gender roles. You know, like, for example, female lionesses, you know, they go out and they hunt and they have a different sort of a gender role, whereas in humans, you know, the job of the female is to guard the egg and the man goes out and gets the, you know, the procures victuals and brings them home and takes care of the woman in a general sense. So when you talk about like things like patriarchy and you talk about oppressive gender roles, do you really think because one gender is oppressing the other, or do you think it's because we've evolved into these gender roles as a means of survival?
I think both of those are a little too simplistic.
Okay.
I think that to deny that some aspects of gender have a biological basis is clearly absurd.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that's mainstream feminism whatsoever. However, there's a point at which we can't know
mm-hmm.
whether or not a gender difference is the result of biology or culture. We cannot really do much to change the aspects of gender which are biological.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing we can really take action on is the culture.
Okay.
And so for that reason, I think it's a little more justified to put the focus on culture, especially where cultural aspects of femininity and masculinity are at this point maladaptive. And I think we see a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one of the things that's come up on my radar recently, which is a story which it has so many different angles, and I want to talk about it from a couple of different angles and get your thoughts about it. In Kansas recently, there was a man who donated sperm to a lesbian couple. And this wasn't done through the state. They didn't go to a licensed doctor. He simply answered a Craigslist ad for a lesbian couple who were looking to have a sperm donor. He signed a private contract with them. And then what happened was that the lesbian couple decided that they couldn't take care of the child, and so they decided to give it up to the state. The state then came and said to the man, well, you're the biological father, you owe child support. How does that make you feel?
This is a perfect example of how rigid definitions of gender roles hurt men and women. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what, you know, there's a great Jezebel article about all these, or a lot of these men's rights issues are actually feminist issues as well. Mm-hmm. And this is a perfect example of this idea that, you know, men are responsible for this and women are responsible for this. It doesn't fit and it doesn't work and it's not helpful.
So you think the state enforces those gender roles with something like this?
I think in the realm of child support and custody, yes, absolutely. These rigid gender roles are enforced by the state to deleterious effect.
Absolutely, yeah. Because, you know, when you talk about things like, you know, a patriarchy or you talk about oppressive gender roles, you know, there's oppression on both sides. And so my problem with it is that it feels as if I've sort of been placed in a role as oppressor by the feminist culture, and when I get down into the nitty gritty and I start looking at it, I see that there's all sorts of inequalities. And I mean, I don't know how you feel about equality, but I'm not necessarily an egalitarian. You know, I don't believe all people are equal, and I don't even necessarily think equal outcomes are possible or feasible. And I certainly don't think the state should be involved in providing equal outcomes for everyone, because not everyone has equal ability. So how do you define equality? Like what sort of equality do you want, and how would you enforce it? I mean, where do you see inequality? Maybe is a good question.
That is a good question. I would say that, for example, the fact that right now there is a choice that women have to make between success and likability that men don't have to make is a great example of inequality.
Okay.
Of opportunity.
Can you give an example, perhaps?
Well, I read about it from Lean In.
Okay.
And I can give an example from my own life. I, you know, work on Young Voices Advocates, and we get submissions in from young men and young women. Mm-hmm. And I've seen several women be concerned about how their voicing their opinion will make them perceived.
Oh.
Basically, the issue is, you know, are people going to not like me? Is this person who I've just criticize going to not like me because
right.
I've written this. I've never had a male ask that question. So yeah, I mean, that's a great example of, you know, if the culture advances to a point where men and women can both succeed and be liked, mm-hmm. will then women be as successful as men? I don't know, but it's still worth going toward. It's still worth working for.
So Hillary Clinton is probably going to run for president in 2016, and looks as if her platform is going to be women's issues, gender issues. So it seems as if, you know, we're going to have to gear up for a debate in your territory.
Right.
And libertarians are going to have to make a decision sort of on how they choose to engage with these issues. Now, one of our mutual friends, I think yesterday or the day before, Gina Luttrell, she posted an article that I think was talking about Rand Paul being racist, and it was sort of supporting Hillary Clinton for president. I mean, and these are kind of the libertarians, and I see a buildup of tension in the movement over this issue. I mean, what do you think? I mean, like, are you a fan of Hillary Clinton? I mean, is she going to be the voice of feminists, the modern feminism? I mean,
oh gosh, I hope not. And that's the issue. Who is going to be the voice of modern feminism? Feminism is not going to be ignored. Equality of opportunity is important. Mm-hmm. And if we are either, again, ignorant of or hostile toward that movement, it will be to our detriment. And I don't want to see that again.
Well, here's the problem. I mean, it seems as if it's sort of an inevitable hostility that will come, because what's going to come is going to be the rhetoric of statism, you know, because they're not just talking about equal rights for women. They're talking about things like the gender pay gap, you know, which is obviously a fallacious economic argument that says that, you know, women earn 77 cents on the dollar for men. But the reality is, when you look at things like pregnancy, being out of the workforce, women's choices for jobs and things like that, then it actually comes down to it when you put men and women in, on a more equal footing, that sometimes women actually make more than men. So, I mean, how are we going to have these kinds of debates, you know, when feminism, as it's going to be mostly known, is going to come in the guise of Hillary Clinton talking about, you know, the gender pay gap? I mean, how can we counter that?
I've thought a lot about this, and I think the first way we can counter that is to be part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And we are part of the conversation when we, instead of saying the gender pay gap is fallacious,
mm-hmm.
saying the reasons for the gender pay gap are women's choices.
Mm-hmm.
The women are making different choices than men because of expectations that are put on them
mm-hmm.
regarding their gender and biology, but again, we're not able to do anything about biology. What can we do about the fact that women are brought up to expect that they will be expected to keep a house clean, to be the primary caregiver for children, to be the primary caregiver for you know, a home and for her parents? How is that affecting her choices? And what can we do about it,
mm-hmm.
right? We're not just gonna say, well, that's good enough, wash my hands, you know, whatever, let women be poorly represented in business and politics. What can we do from a voluntary perspective through education and cultural change to help women be on equal footing as far as opportunity?
Well, that's a good question. But I mean, I think that a lot of feminists would probably say, well, we'd be better off if we had Hillary Clinton elected, for example, over a Rand Paul. I don't know how you are on voting. I think you're an ANCAP, right? So for you, voting is probably not a big issue. But I mean, I guess I just see this conflict coming and libertarianism not ready to debate these issues at all, because what I see is, like, with the debate that you had with Julie, you were focusing on issues of privilege, and you were talking about privilege afforded to white people in terms of the war on drugs, because African Americans, for example, are more highly incarcerated. But I mean, don't libertarians already focus on those issues? I mean, what does privilege have to do with it when it seems as if the issues you're discussing don't necessarily have to do with privilege as much as it seems it has to do with the role of the state? And I mean, I guess my question here is, if I could just boil it down, is that feminism and libertarianism seem to be at odds in certain ways, and then in other ways they seem compatible. But I mean, isn't what you're really just pushing just straight up individualism, not necessarily feminism?
Right. So where I was trying, there's a lot to respond to here, but
sure.
I'll try. To go back to the Hillary Clinton thing,
mm-hmm.
Libertarianism, as it is constituted now, is poorly equipped to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't need to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Libertarianism and feminism are not fundamentally at odds whatsoever. The issue with privileges, from my kind of experience, is that, sure, like I said, we can go back and we can say all of the solutions that we're positing are just individualism. You know, they all support individual liberty.
Right.
And I believe in individual liberty, and I believe that privilege, acknowledging privilege, is in no way, shape, or form incompatible with or mutually exclusive to individual liberty.
Mm-hmm.
Privilege, they're not at all. I believe
mm-hmm.
that acknowledging privilege, acknowledging that men can be likable and successful and women can't,
mm-hmm.
understanding that, instead of making it more difficult to advocate for individual liberty, it makes it easier.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you more fully understand the challenges to individual liberty.
Mm-hmm. So, one last topic. There's been sort of, with every revolution, there's always sort of a counter-revolutionary movement. And when feminism sort of, you know, sprung up throughout the 60s and 70s, there's been different waves. You know, there's first wave feminism, second wave, third wave, and now we're in, I think, what they're calling post-third wave feminism. And I've been reading this one author. She recently died. She was a Nobel Prize winner. Her name was Doris Lessing. She's a fantastic author and very outspoken feminist. But before she died, she was complaining about modern feminism, and she was saying that men are now being abused and cowed and pushed into corners and told they can't say anything about these issues. We're called mansplainers,
mm-hmm.
for example. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, like, don't men have their own issues that they should be able to speak out on necessarily? Not without being overly collectivist, but I mean, when feminists push men into a corner on certain things like that, don't you think there's necessarily always a sort of balancing reaction to that? And is that so wrong necessarily? Because, quite frankly, a lot of feminists do kind of make fun of the men's rights. Some people, they have, you know, talk about the fedoras, and they make fun of, like, their, you know, their beards on their neck, the neck beards, yeah.
Right,
so,
right.
But I mean, isn't it necessarily, you know, don't they have issues too, and don't they deserve to be heard and not told that they're mansplaining?
I believe, of course, the modern American man has big issues,
mm-hmm.
huge issues. I think you can see that economically, educationally, marriage-wise, huge issues, especially the low-income, low-skill, low-education American man.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a mistake to this narrative that women's success has been at the expense of men. I think that's not true at all. I think the economy has basically changed, mm-hmm. and it's changed in such a way that the way we socialize women has ironically been to their advantage in a lot of ways. Like you said,
right.
single childless women in cities are out earning their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
Women who kind of, you know, overcome the programming to drop out and lean back are seeing real rewards for their efforts. So I think it's, you know, the men's rights movement often, and feminism also, creates this false dichotomy where it's men against women, and I think that's really unfortunate and counterproductive to both of their efforts.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's interesting. Well, yeah, we could probably talk for hours, Kathy. This was really fascinating. I got to cut it off now because I want to keep it short. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for watching the Freedom Report. This is Kathy Reisenwitz here. We're talking about sex in the state. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. You can find us on iTunes. And don't forget the LibertarianRepublic.com every day for the best news from the perspective of economic freedom and personal liberty.